Hello and welcome. You have tuned in to episode number 434 of Linux in the Ham Shack, the most terrific amateur radio podcast on the internet. And tonight we're running one person short, but that's all right. It's our deep dive episode, and we are going to kind of turn back the clock a little bit on this episode and go back to the beginning, kind of like Inigo Montoya. When the job went wrong, you went back to the beginning, and that's where we're going. We're going to talk a little bit about getting boot media for your Linux distribution. And before we dive into it, we'll go ahead and introduce ourselves. I'm Russ, K5TUX. Cheryl, W5MOO, is not here.
And I'm Bill, NE4RD.
So
I got a frog in my throat, apparently.
Just showed up, too. Jumped right
yeah,
in there.
Yeah, it was fine a few seconds ago.
It's all right. So, excellent. So, there was, I believe this was kind of spurred, those are two totally different meaning words. This was spurred by an email, right? You responded to an email about boot ISOs or generating boot Linux ISOs.
Actually, we had a couple of comments that said that I really enjoy your content, but it's at really such a high level right now in our series of what we're going over that is really hard for beginners to get started. So I thought we had kind of, you know, would maybe take a step back and say, well, you know, we probably have covered this before in episodes and probably just kind of pass over it as if everybody knows exactly how to get, you know, their ISO image and get it either on a thumb drive or a DVD and actually get their system going. So I thought it would probably be worth our time to at least touch on it in some level of detail of how you can start with a Windows computer or a Mac computer, or maybe just another old installation of Linux, and get yourself to the new install via a new ISO image. And yeah, surprisingly, a lot of people don't know how to actually go from an ISO image to some kind of boot media, you know. So I thought it was would be interesting for us to kind of revisit this very low level, simple topic that really gets everybody started. I mean, yeah, if you're starting in Linux, you start here. So yeah, that's why we got here.
All right. Excellent. And most people, if they're coming to Linux who don't already just start from some installation media they've already got, will be coming from a different operating system, most likely. And most likely that would be Windows. And so the three applications we've got that we're going to talk about are actually cross-platform. They'll run on anything, Windows, Mac, and Linux. But we're kind except of focusing.
Rufus won't.
Okay, yeah, Rufus is definitely a Windowsy thing. But we're kind of coming from the idea that you don't have Linux now, and you want to be able to boot it, whether it's alive or whatever kind of distribution. This is more or less for physical machines because VMs can boot an ISO file directly, so you don't have to have special like physical media like a DVD or a thumb drive. In a virtual machine environment. So this is if you want to do an install on, you know, bare metal, basically. So the first of the applications we're going to talk about is the one that I use all the time because it's the easiest. It's super simple, but Bill can walk us all through it, I guess. And it's called Rufus. I don't know why it's called Rufus. I never actually bothered to look and see if there was some reason it was called Rufus, but, it's a great utility and it's super easy to use. So how do you use it?
I don't know. I don't know what it's called either, why it's called that. I have used it for years and years and years. But yeah, Rufus is a utility that helps format and create bootable USB flash drives, such as, you know, keys and pen drives and memory sticks, etc. It can be especially useful for cases where, you know, you need to keep create a USB installation media from, I don't know, a bootable ISO like Linux or possibly even Windows or something that needs UEFI. You need to work on a system that doesn't have an OS to install. This is another option. Sorry. You will, you know, this is a useful case would also be to if you want to use a working system that doesn't have an OS to install on. So let's say you're doing some drive maintenance or something like that. You can go ahead and, you know, write a bootable ISO image onto a thumb drive or something like that. So you can do some drive maintenance and stuff like that. Or you want to run some low level utility like a memory checker or something like that. That's not, that's not able to run directly from the machine you're on or the boot installation that you're actually running on, like Windows or Mac or something like that. So it's a really cool tool, but it is only available for Windows, and it has been available for Windows for quite a while, and it will definitely make any kind of disk. And I believe the last time I ran it, it also has the ability to run in DD mode, which we'll talk about a little bit later, I think, because it's on the list of items to talk about. So it can do a pure straight copy disk image to disk image without doing any extra magic. But the nice part about Rufus is it kind of adds a little extra magic to the whole process. So it makes it real easy to get any ISO image from any, you know, Arch Linux, you know, Fedora, what have you, actually burnt onto a thumb drive, so you can boot it.
Yes, that's correct. You're sounding very screw it. Pick a big word and it came from mellifluous. That's it.
I don't even know what that means.
Sonorous, you know, something like that. So basically, all of these techniques start with an ISO file. So you have to go to probably a website to download said ISO file, like Ubuntu.com or ArchLinux.org or some site. They'll have
getfedora.org.
Getfedora.org, right.
Or media.ne4rd.live or our homepage where you link to it.
Right. And in Windows, of course, you know, it's just going to be a click on the ISO file and download it. So no big deal there. Macintosh, of course, will be the same. So once you have your ISO file, you'll need to put it onto some sort of boot media, whether it be a DVD, which is kind of really old school at this point, or a USB thumb drive, which is most likely what you're going to be doing nowadays. And I will say that for any modern distribution that has a full-sized ISO, you're going to want a bare minimum of a 4 gig thumb drive, but probably 8 would be safer.
Yes.
And if you, we weren't really going to talk about this, but I'll just mention it. You can make these actual running distros if you set up persistence. So if you want to use the thumb drive as your actual operating system's disk drive, which you probably won't, but you can. But if you're going to do that, make sure your drive is much bigger than 8 gigs, probably 64 or 128, something like that. Something on the order of an actual flash drive.
And if you do persistence, which again, we're not talking about, buy a very expensive one. One that's
right.
From a reputable brand and has some reliability statistics behind it. Because, if this is your primary drive, if you're going to use a thumb drive as your primary drive, that's not a good idea in general. It generally is bad. They are not as good as like an SSD or something like that, that actually has, a longer warranty period and some reliability statistics for having it inside of your computer constantly hashing and thrashing. Your thumb drives really aren't designed for that kind of stuff. So they do have limited lifespans on reads and writes. So definitely look into that if you are going to look into persistence.
Right. But we're going to go forth as if you're not going to do persistence and you're going to be installing the operating system on some sort of hard drive, whether it be solid state or otherwise, that's already in your machine, which will most likely be larger and better built for doing persistent storage. So if you download Rufus, because that's what you would do first. Well, you could do it first or second. You can download Rufus first or you can download the ISO first. Doesn't really matter. But Rufus is an application that just sort of runs on its own. You know, you don't have to install it per se. You just double click on it. It runs. It presents you with a really easy interface. If you already have your thumb drive inserted into the computer, it will detect it and show you that that's the target. And if you don't, you just plug your thumb drive in after you've started Rufus and it will find it. And Rufus is just sort of a one-click thing. It wipes the thumb drive and does the install, and then it tells you it's done and it should be bootable at that point. You do have to do one thing, and that's select the ISO file. So if you're on Windows, for example, you'll download it into your downloads directory. You click on the boot selection, I think is the field. Under boot selection on the right, there's a button that says select. You click select, you find your file, your ISO file. It will have already discovered your thumb drive. You can set a volume label if you like, but it's not necessary. Everything else should probably stay as default in the case of a Linux ISO. And when you've done that, click start, wait about 15 minutes, and you have a bootable thumb drive. You should be able to reboot your computer at that point, and assuming your BIOS is set up to boot from USB media, it should just start happening. If we can't really go into like every BIOS, you know, manufacturer,
yeah,
and tell you how to switch your boot drive priority and whether or not it boots from USB media and stuff like that. Any modern BIOS will do it automatically, but sometimes you'll have to do something like press escape or F12 or something like that to get into a place where it will actually boot from a USB device. But that is computer and manufacturer independent, so just be aware of that. But anything reasonably new should just do it. You have anything else to add to that?
If you do it on a Mac, you hold down your option key.
Yes.
And that's pretty standard across almost every Mac.
Right. If you hold down the option key until you hear the Apple bong, then it will present you with all of your boot drive options. And your thumb drive should be one of the listed options. You click on it, and away you go. And you've wiped off that nasty Mac OS.
Nasty. It's all that BSD bastardization.
As it's being used right now to record this program. So
sad.
Yeah, I
know. Sad Mac.
Well, at least I'm not getting a sad Mac. That's a good thing.
That's a good sign. Yeah.
All right. I didn't actually read down through your notes on Rufus. So have we touched everything?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Rufus is pretty easy to use. It's pretty standard. I think I used one of the other utilities before I found Rufus. So we're going to talk about a couple other utilities that you can find easily online. And we should probably just move on to the next one that basically does the same thing.
It does more or less the same thing. I've only used Balina Etcher once, and it was on a Mac OS to install Linux on a Mac, and it didn't work, but I think that's because of the age of my Mac. I don't think it really had anything to do with Etcher, but I'm really not familiar with Etcher, although it does present the same sort of interface and does everything pretty much the same. I was just doing it on a Mac, so I'll let you flesh out the details on Etcher if you've got more to say about it.
Yeah, so Etcher, let's just run over the copy here real quick. It's a powerful OS image flasher built with web technologies. That means it's probably Electron. To ensure flashing an SD card or USB drive is pleasant and safe experience. And, you know, make sure that it doesn't, in the drive selection segment, it doesn't select your hard drive, which is always helpful. So you don't flash your hard drive with an ISO image, which I have done once. And it's a bit ugly. Undoing that. I do not recommend that at all. So it protects you from accidentally writing to your hard drives, and it also allows you to flash Raspberry Pi SD cards as well. And I think that's what I've used it probably more for, but I tend to use that for quite a bit of stuff. In fact, I've seen some distributions actually modify Etcher so it has a downloader and everything else built into it. So they must allow some extensibility to the product as well, where you can actually have it download your ISO and then burn it and then write to your thumb drive and stuff like that. Nice part about this application, it is available for Windows, Mac OS, and Linux. Linux is an app image. I believe there are some other direct builds as well, maybe a deb and possibly a RPM, but there's definitely an app image that works everywhere, so that's really nice, and it looks and operates exactly the same way in every OS. I think I have used it even in Mac OS once, so it's a kind of a clean, it literally has like a pick your file, pick your drive, go. Flash. You don't get any other options. There's no advanced settings and stuff like that. So it's really kind of clean and simple to use. I don't even know what the license is on it, but it doesn't really matter because you're going to use it for this one purpose and this one purpose only, which is to write your image.
Right. I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about here anyway. It's just stuff to write your image, and then you're kind of done with it. Then you go on to the glory of having Linux installed on your machine. I'm gonna throw one in here that is not on our list, and we're not really going to talk about it because it's kind of exactly the same as the other two we've just talked about. It's one that's been around for a while. It's associated with Pendrive Linux, which is a site that's been around a real long time. And this one is called the Universal USB Installer, or UUI. There'll be a link for information about it in the show notes. But again, it's for Windows. It presents the same single window, you know, choose a drive, choose an ISO, click, boom, away you go. So just another one you could choose if you want to. I think one of the things about Rufus and potentially Etcher that is better than UUI is they tend to be faster. Rufus does better direct writing to the media as opposed to things like UUI, which for some reason they should all kind of do the same thing. There may be a verification process or something. I can't remember if Rufus or Etcher has a like post-write verification step.
Etcher does for sure. And I think it's optional on Rufus.
Okay, so if you're really worried about your installation media, you can do a verify. It will do an actual byte-for-byte verify of the write. Generally, I avoid that because it takes usually several times longer than the actual write to do the verify, and it's generally unnecessary. Unless you found your thumb drive under the tire of a car in the mud or something like that, then you're probably okay. So verify, you know, at your own behest, I guess. Oh, are you gonna read, or do you want me to read this thing about you?
I just pasted it in there. I think you covered it well enough. I just added the extra copy in our show notes and a link to it, so that's already set up. And I did want to make one mention on thumb drives. I kind of gone to using an SD card writer as my thumb drive for just general use around the, you know, doing ISO images and stuff like that, because I found it really easy to slide the little SD cards in and write it, use it once, and then either keep it aside and do a different OS on a different SD card. That way I don't have to have tons of thumb drives around. I just have tons of these little tiny micro SD cards everywhere.
I've done that as well. I've gone to the micro SD cards and a little, you know, because the little, I don't know what you'd call them, like the interface or the dongle or whatever it is, yeah. That
they're super that, tiny now.
Yeah, they're just barely bigger. They're big enough to seat themselves into the USB port and big enough to slide the micro SD card in it, and then that's about it. They're basically the size of your thumbnail.
Yeah,
and really just cool. Make sure you don't lose them.
So I have several.
Yeah, I have several myself. I also have one that's in the shape of a USB thumb drive. So it's a little bit bigger, and it actually has the card reader on the side, which can do regular SD cards. So you plug into the USB, but the regular SD converter, you know, adapter, and then the micro SD card into it. So that comes in handy sometimes too.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so that's, I guess, all we need to say about UUI. And the last one is one that's been around a real long time, which is UNET Bootin. And I know we've talked about this several times on the show, but probably in the very distant past. It's short for the Universal NetBoot Installer. And NetBooting, you know, did any other distros other than, like, Debian do NetBooting stuff where they had that minimal ISO?
Yes.
Okay.
I think I started Gen 2 that way with a NetBoot and a couple other ones, but this one has kind of grown away from just that. It also allows you to download the distribution in the application as well. So I think that's the new net side of NetBootin.
Okay, well, you go ahead and keep going then.
Yeah, so you're presented with a very similar UI that almost looks like Rufus, except for it has a few extra options. At the very top, you have a ability to select a distribution, and they have quite a wide variety of distributions that you're familiar with, like Ubuntu and Linux Mint and Debian and a bunch of other ones there that are handy. You can actually just download it directly in the application, so it'll download your ISO image. Has a version selector. Should there be multiple versions, you could download. And then you have the selection of just the disk image. If you just want to do a disk image that you've already downloaded, you can select that. And then it asks you how you want to actually write it. And, you know, typically it's USB drive and which drive letter it actually is on your Windows computer. And it also has the ability to do persistence for Ubuntu only. And it actually has an option to set that size if you want to set a persistence layer for your Ubuntu live installation. So that is the kind of the cool things about UNetBootin. If you're looking for persistence, it definitely has an easy way to do it in an install. So highly recommend this tool. I've used it probably a million times.
Yeah, and the fact that it does allow you to download without having to go to the website first, you can pick a distribution and it will download it for you, or you can do a local ISO if you've already downloaded one. So that is a nice feature as well as the ability to set up persistence if you so desire it.
Right, and it does work in Mac and Windows, or Mac and Linux, apparently. I've never used it in Linux, but apparently it does work in Linux, works in Mac as well.
Yep, I've only used it on Windows as well, but it's nice to know that it crosses platforms. Yay! I put in a couple of things in here for doing writes to USB thumb drives. They're actually sort of generic techniques for just writing data onto some media. But when I have a Linux installation or if I'm using Windows subsystem for Linux, these are ways that you can write an ISO to a thumb drive as well. There's two different ones that I have here. The first one is DD, which is just a shell utility. And I can't remember what DD stands for, but it's basically literally a utility for writing bytes in order. So the ISO file is going to be like 2.3 gigabytes or whatever of bytes. And all DD does is take every byte in order from byte 0 to byte, you know, N, and copies it from the original file to another file. And that file doesn't have to be a device file. So you could do a DD of something.iso to something2.iso, and it would literally just copy it byte for byte. Now, there are faster ways to do this on Linux. You definitely wouldn't want to do that, but it's an easy way to write a USB thumb drive. The only thing you have to know is the device that is the thumb drive. You know, whether it's /dev/SDABC, whatever. More than likely it's gonna be one of those. If you're doing a computer that's /dev/HD something, it's too old, throw it away. Yeah, and it basically copies, it's a byte copy from one file to another file. And in the case of DD, if you want to write an ISO file, the nice thing about it is if that file happens to be a device file, i.e. like dev/sdc, it will create the image on that device file. And that device file, of course, is a thumb drive. I mentioned the PV utility. It stands for packet view, I think. Maybe not packet view, something view. Oh, no, pipe view. Pipe view is what it is. And what you can do is you can, if you're doing something like DD, it doesn't have a snazzy little progress indicator like some of these other utilities do. So if you pipe the output of DD into PV, it will generate a progress indicator for you. So you know how far along your write to your thumb drive is. And I find that particularly useful. I'll actually include the specific commands that I use when I'm writing an ISO in this way in the show notes. And then there's another one called DD Rescue. And if you're worried about, you know, GPL and licensing and all that stuff, DD Rescue is, I can't remember if it's the FSF that does, or GNU, but it's one of those ones that conforms to all the copyleft and everything. It's very safe. And there's a couple of magic incantations and flags you use for DD Rescue, and does the same thing. It takes an input file and writes to an output block device like a thumb drive.
It's a GNU.
It's GNU. Yeah. Okay.
And you can get a progress indicator in DD nowadays with a status equals progress on the end of your command line. So you can actually see what it's doing. Cause that was always a fun thing. It's like, I wonder what it's doing.
Well, I'll just put it mine here. Let's see. IF equals ISO file. That's another way to do it. I haven't looked at status equals progress, so I don't know how pretty that status indicator is. But the PV one is pretty cool. And it's also a little more portable because it will show the progress of any pipe, not just DD. So DD is useful for DD. Cool.
Yeah. Sometimes you do have to worry about block size too when you're using DD. So pay attention to the DD instructions that you see at the Linux distributions instructions. So yeah, apparently I'm not very loud in the stream. Anyway, yeah. So yeah, the block size is important, and I know of at least one distribution that's really whiny if you do not use DD, and that's Solus. For some reason, they do require the use of DD to write your image. So you definitely want to follow the instructions if you're into using Solus, and you want to burn that onto a USB stick from Linux or something like that.
Very good. So do we have anything else to say about creating bootable ISOs?
Not really. I mean, the days of computers having disk drives and stuff like that are pretty much gone. I think I still have one computer here that actually has a DVD drive in it. So that's why you don't see many people talking about making DVD images out of stuff. Plus, these ISO creators have gotten really large and fat with their installation media, exceeding the sizes of DVDs, at least generic DVDs, until you get like multi-layer and so on and so forth. So yeah, the easiest way nowadays to get your boot installation going is on a thumb drive, and that's why we're talking about it as if that's the only way, because in general it feels like it really is.
Well, a DVD can hold 4.7 gigabytes of raw data, so you're going to get some less than that when you're writing out an ISO file. And that's probably good enough for a lot of distributions, but certainly not all. And the other thing is optical media runs way slower than a thumb drive or an SD card. So you're going to see a major performance hit if a DVD is your only option. And you'd have to go back a ways into the Debian verse if you wanted to get into CD media, because you haven't been able to boot from a CD for some time.
Oh yeah, that's what, 720 megs or something like that.
Yeah,
so tiny.
Yeah. So you're looking at a DVD, man. If you're looking at a DVD, don't look at a DVD. USB boot drive is or USB thumb drive. That's the way you want to go for sure.
All right,
cool. So if anybody has any specific questions, or if you have, checked out the show notes and think we've missed a step or don't have all the information handy, please send us some email and we'll respond to you and let you know if there's something we missed. Although, I mean, the whole point of these ISO creators is to make the process very simple. So as long as you know where to download the ISO from, and as long as you've got a thumb drive handy, any of these should make the process really, really simple for getting started with Linux. I think that's all I got to say about it.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good coverage. I mean, yeah, if you have issues and want more information or have something else to say, definitely send us a line at info.lhspodcast.info or send us a voicemail at what?
1-909-547-7469, which is 1-909-LHS-SHOW on your touchtone keypad.
We do have a question.
Darren actually has a question. Yeah. How can I tell which thumb drives will not work as a boot disk? They will all work as a boot disk because it has to do with how the data is written to the thumb drive. So they'll all work as long as they're big enough. That's right. Really the only caveat. So,
well, the other one is that your system has to allow you to be able to boot.
To boot. Right.
USB thumb drive. And that's where you knowing your computer and how to get into the boot sequence, which a lot of computers nowadays are like, you hit F12 and it gets you to a one-time boot menu. Some are more complicated than that. But yeah, that's your mileage may vary as soon as that comes to fruition.
Yeah, we touched on that earlier in the program. You definitely have to know your BIOS a little bit, and you have to know if your computer can boot the media. But if it can, one way or the other, whether it's automatic or whether it's something you have to get into a boot menu for, then the media itself shouldn't make any difference. They're all the same. I mean, they're just raw repositories for data. So it used to be that Windows, like if you wanted to create a Windows boot media stick, you had to go, well, you still kind of have to still go through a special process because of creating the master boot record and all that kind of stuff. But these ISO creators do all that stuff for you. Hopefully that answered the question.
He's typing.
Yeah, I know. In the meantime, we should probably move on to our feedback, because we do have some feedback. Oh, let's see. My daughter's computer is fussy with some sticks. Thought it was the stick that is the issue. I can't imagine it's the stick unless there is something physically wrong with the stick. If you write an ISO file to it and do a verify to make sure that the write is correct, it should work.
There's one more thing. If your computer's old enough to have USB 2.0 and USB 3.0 ports on it, generally it only likes booting off of the USB 2.0 ports. This was common in some of the older Dell units and stuff like that. So if you have a mixture of ports, you might want to look at where you're plugging it in at, because it might not always be the one you think it can plug into. And that, again, that's very computer specific. And, you know, I have a computer here that actually has that problem. So I always remember it's on the left side of the computer I plug it into, not the right side. Otherwise, the right side, it doesn't see it at all.
Yeah, I have an HP laptop, actually a couple of HP laptops that only like to boot off of one port. They're all USB 2, but only one of them is set up to read at boot time. So yeah, that may be another caveat. And, you know, at a glance, USB 3 and up ports are blue if you look at them, and the older ones are black. So that gives you a visual representation of which ports might be valid for booting from. All right, so on to announcements and feedback. I didn't put any announcements in here because I don't think there are any, but we do have some feedback. I got an email a little while ago, a week and a half ago, I think, from HyFlux7. No names or call signs or anything, but apparently they're a longtime listener, who said, getting error on today's episode via the RSS feed, couldn't connect to server, bsmarchive.info, traceroute makes it to the machine just fine, whatever process is listening on port 443 must be borked, 73V, whoever V is. I did some investigation into this, and what it turned out to be was the intermediate certificate in the certificate chain for bsmarchive.info had expired. So it was failing verification. And so any feed readers that were downloading an SSL version of the file were complaining. So I got that fixed like within a few hours. So hopefully people didn't really notice that. I hate when that happens because I mean, that wasn't even my fault. It's like nothing I could do about that. I didn't even realize that I'm not even sure if it was an expiration or a revocation, but something in the Let's Encrypt certificate chain went away. So I had to fix that. All right. And I guess I'll touch on this next one. We might both have something to say about this. There's a comment on the Linux and Amtrak website from Bob K0TAZ. He says, hi guys. I'm a longtime ham new to Linux. I just installed Ubuntu on my PC along with Windows 10. I installed FLDigi, WSJTX, CQRLog, and FLRig. I use an IC7610 with HRD as rig control, presumably under Windows because it doesn't run under Linux anymore. So my question is, do I use FLRig to control the rig or use HRD? Well, I just sort of answered that question. You have to use FLRig or something like it because HRD doesn't run on Linux. And what are the settings for FLDigi and WSJTX using the 7610? I have watched too many vids on setting up Linux for ham radio. Then I found you guys. You make more sense.
Uh-oh. Well, we're doing it wrong.
Still way over my head, but getting there. Hi. I think I have loaded too much in Ubuntu. Should have done VM to practice first. Hi. Any ideas where to start? Any help would be appreciated. 73 Bob. So I did answer him briefly. I mentioned that they would have to use FLRig or something similar to do rig control because of the lack of support for HRD in Linux. And sounds like he's got a dual boot system, so obviously he can't do both at the same time, unless he's got a VM environment, which he clearly could have, but apparently doesn't. And he also wants to know like what the settings would be for an IC7610. I would think an FLRig would be /dev/tty USB0 because it presents its own USB devices, probably two of them.
Yes, one with for the sound, digital, one for rig control, yeah.
Right. So it's either going to be /dev/tty USB0 or USB1, whichever one it chooses for rig control and audio. The it's a 9600 8N1 by default on ICOM rigs. And I also mentioned to him about WFU because WFU will work really well with an IC7610 because that's one of the newer ones with the pan adapter and all that.
Oh, yeah, and, sure. Yeah.
And WFU, I can't, is it it's going to integrate with Rig Control D, right? I think, or does?
Yeah, I think it has an ability for you to connect something else to it. I haven't used it since we started talking about it, but I was going to circle back and look at it again. But I believe that's the idea, that it could be used as a pass-through, so it becomes the rig control server for everything else that needs to talk to the rig.
Right. And I mean, I don't want to go into like that too in-depth, but even if you're not using it for rig control specifically, WFU will give you a nice on-screen view of your 7610, even if you're using FL Rig or just going into HamLib using Rig Control or Rig Control D directly to control the 7610. That's a real basic overview. So if you have any additional questions, and I did outline the ports and the port parameters.
Yeah. When you select the 7610, because it should show up, like you select your rig first, so you tell it it's an IC7610 in FL Rig. And then the device pop down, a drop down, should have all your enumerated serial devices. And it should also show the ones by ID. So it'll look like one that is, you know, /dev by ID, blah, 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 something, something, something. But it'll be very specific to your rig. And that's really the one you want to use. You don't want to have to try to guess whether it's TTSY1 or S0 or S2 or whatever. It should have a by ID one. And then when you go into FL Digi or WSJTX, you just tell it that it's using FL Rig. And then it learns from FL Rig where your rig is. So you don't have to really do anything extra. So in WSJTX, you would just say, my rig control is FL Rig. And that's it. And it should just start working.
And I don't know if, like, on ICOM rigs have the CIV.
Yeah, if you've messed with that, it won't be default. But if you haven't messed with it, it should be the default, which is something like 91H or something like that.
I think it's 88H is the default for CIV. So
okay, yeah, something like that. But it should be default. You shouldn't, unless you know you've messed with it, it should be the default. Right. And if you know you messed with it and maybe got into a little trouble there, you can always reset those settings in your rig itself.
All right. Yeah. So if you have any additional questions, you've already emailed me a couple of times. So feel free to, well, actually, I think it was a message on Facebook, but
yeah, that's right.
So if you have any additional questions or need additional help with getting that set up, please let us know and we'll do what we can to help. And thanks for writing in, Bob K0TAZ. And Bill, this is a comment on your YouTube video, so we'll go ahead and let you address this one.
Yeah, Ken here, W6BZY, has left a few comments on our YouTube channel, and I've tried to answer them all there, but we'll go ahead and just touch on two of his questions that he popped in there. The first one was, Fedora is probably not a good choice for hams who got started on the Raspberry Pi. And that's possibly true, because they're probably used to Raspbian, which, of course, is, you know, Debian, which is Ubuntu-friendly and everything else. Being a testing ground for Red Hat and a different package manager makes for issues. Yeah, it's a little different. I had to add myself to the dial-out group. Haven't had to do that in a while. Well, you do have to do that in Linux, for sure. On the other hand, Arch uses yet another package manager, the AUR and new problems. Yeah, and it doesn't have a dial-out group. It uses a UUID or something like that, or UUCD or something. It's a totally different group
you have to be part of. Probably.
Yeah, UUCP. Yeah, UUCP is the group for that. So you need to add yourself to that group for Arch. You were lucky with setting up CQR log. If you have tried to create a new log, you would have found it does not work and hasn't for the past couple of months. I've notified the maintainer and he's working for upstream help. I would like to if you focused more on how you do things so your videos can help us learn to use Linux in the ham shack. Okay, that's what I'm trying to do. I enjoy the podcast, but I'm a very visual learner, so videos are better for me. You got me started 3 years ago using Linux in my shack. Well, that's awesome. That's awesome. And yeah, we're trying to make the videos so that they show all the steps along the way. And I think the Fedora video showed the most steps, but I didn't show, you know, creating a new log. I actually just imported my old log by copying the .config/CQR log directly in to my user profile. And of course it just worked from scratch, but I will be doing a refreshed new video that shows specifically that. And we'll see if we can reproduce it in Fedora and Arch and maybe Ubuntu, just to kind of show the ways to get around that. And most of it has to do with the fact that if you don't get MariaDB installed first, it tends to not work right. Somehow the MySQL server just makes things icky and ugly for for the installation of CQR log. So I'll try to address that in a video for you as well, but I have answered you on the YouTube channel. So hopefully you'll get back to me there or some other means of getting back to us here. Maybe join the Discord channel and we can help you more interactively. And as well, he left a comment that he just installed Manjaro GNOME and CQR log bin from the AUR. And then he asked, how do I open an existing file? Which I just kind of told you, if you had an existing file in your .config/CQR log directory from another installation, you can definitely use that whole directory and just bring it all in from a previous working installation, and everything should just work. And again, I'll circle back around and I'll take a look at doing creating a new log inside of those environments. So we can have a record of it working or not working, and possibly me working around it not working. So I think that'll be very helpful for you and others that are in the same predicament with CQR log.
All right, very good. Well, that brings us down to the end of the feedback, and therefore the end of the show. So I want to thank everybody who was listening to us live, even though we're recording at an odd time and day. But we did have a couple of listeners. We had Tony, K4XSS, and we had Darren, VK60K. And apparently, according to the Icecast stream, there were a couple of people listening over there as well. We don't know who they are, but thanks for tuning in. And this has been the deep dive into making a bootable ISO to get your Linux system up and running. We hope it was at least a little entertaining and definitely educational. And don't forget to send us email at info@lhspodcast.info. or leave us a voicemail at 909-547-7469 if you have any questions or comments or follow-ups to this episode. And with that, we'll go ahead and get on out of here. And the next one we do is the Weekender, so make sure to tune in for that if you're into Weekender-y type stuff. And in the meantime, have a great week, and we'll catch you for the next one. This has been episode number 434 of Linux in the Ham Shack for the On Assignment, Cheryl, W5MOO. I'm Russ, K5TUX.
And I'm Bill, NE4RD73.